Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Plotlines. I'm your host, Connor. Happy St. George's Day. I have a very special guest with me. I have Dr. Taylor Marshall, the author of Sword and Serpent. And thank you for coming on, Taylor. It's wonderful to have you back.
Good to be back, Connor. How are you on this Feast of St. George?
I'm doing well. St. George's Feast is a very, very special day for me. My grandpa had a very strong devotion to St. George, so it's very good to remember him on that day. Mm-hmm. And it's also my birthday. Good to,
you know, we just had the big Earth Day, secular holiday, Earth Day, and I think it's good to note right at the beginning of your show today that the name George is Greek, and the first two letters GE, gay, is the Greek word for earth, the world. And orgos has to do with like ergy, like metallurgy. It means like ergonomics. It's the working. So ge orgos means worker of the earth, farmer. So George is an icon. He is a sign of Adam, who is a tiller of the earth, in the opening chapters of Genesis. And Adam was a tiller of the earth, and his wife spoke with the dragon, with the serpent, and Adam didn't do his job, and the serpent defeated the woman. And in the story of St. George, we have a Christological new Adam, a farmer, a georgos, a worker of the earth, but he slays the dragon. So he is in line with Christ the King, who is the defeater, the victor over the dragon. So to truly celebrate the world, it's not through ecology, it's through Christ. And I think St. George is their image. He's our icon of that. So hopefully we can talk about, is George real? Are dragons real? Who is this woman that he rescued from the dragon? Some accounts say Sabra, some say Eva. In my book, I use both. And retell this story for a new generation and get people excited, especially young people, get them excited about St. George.
Indeed, especially, you know, he's also the patron saint of England. And England is in a very precarious time right now. And it's the flag of St. George is considered, you know, I don't know, almost like a hate symbol nowadays in England, with the woke and such.
Yeah. And you know, it's the novel Dracula, and Dracula is a Latin diminutive meaning little dragon, right? So Dracula is a little dragon. He sucks your blood. He's demonic. That novel begins, if you read the novel, the opening chapters, it begins on the Feast of St. George. So even Bram, you know, Stoker, who's a Protestant, and he's kind of tapping into Catholic themes, but even the Dracula story harkens to this English reminiscence of St. George as the one who overcomes the Dracon. Dracula, the little dragon. So yeah, it's and of course George is the patron of many other countries, not just England. But yeah, he is an icon, and he comes back to Europe. He was more of a Middle Eastern saint, and he comes back to Europe after the Crusades. And this is when you see devotion to St. George blossom in places like, of course, England, but also France, Germany, Austria, these places where the Crusaders are coming back, because there was an apparition of St. George during the Crusades. He, of course, is a patron of knights, of celibacy, of battle, of war under the banner of Jesus Christ. And so he signifies everything that was in the Crusader ideal. And so when they go to the Jerusalem and they fight, they gain this devotion to St. George, who originally Constantine built the first church to St. George in the Middle East. They become aware of this, and they bring this devotion of the celibate warrior who destroys the dragon. They bring this back to Europe, and it becomes an icon up into our day.
That Constantine building that church, that's a very like recent experience for him too, like for Constantine. Like he's a very recent saint.
Constantine the emperor?
Did you say Constantine built that? Built it the first church, or who did you
say? Yeah, Constantine the emperor from the 300s built, I believe, the first church dedicated to St. George.
Well, and St. George is, I mean, your book starts in, what is it, 290, is that what it is, or 299?
Yes, 299. My book starts in 299.
So it's a very recent story that would be being told, a very recent saint to have been martyred.
Yeah, so George, you know, according to tradition, died in 303 in the year of our Lord, 303. My book starts in 299, and the trilogy goes from 299 AD to 303 AD. So it's, you know, a little over 3 years of the life, the end of the life of St. George, and how he interacts with Constantine. So I don't want to give away the whole trilogy, but I mean, in a way, the trilogy is just as much about St. George as it is about Constantine and the conversion of the empire. And if you look at the icons, the depiction of defeating the dragon and the role of the martyrs in the defeating of pagan imperial Rome and converting it to Christ, that whole, I mean, the icon of St. George is a mystical retelling of martyrdom personified in George defeating the dragon of the Roman Empire, who is the fourth beast of the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation, the apocalypse. So, I mean, that's, we just kind of just went really deep right there, but that's what I was trying to accomplish. And I think I did accomplish in Sword and Serpent, doing a historical fiction retelling novel of what was going on with these martyrs in the catacombs in relationship to the Roman Empire. And then you see, beginning in 303, and I have Constantine in there, but he's pagan. He hasn't even had the vision of the sign at the Milvian Bridge. You know, none of this future manifestation of the gradual conversion of Constantine has happened. But already George and other martyrs who do come in contact with Constantine are starting to plant these seeds, which will then come to fruition in 313, and then in 325 at the Council of Nicaea, and then in the building of the Holy Sepulchre, the Church of the Resurrection in Jerusalem, so on and so forth. So this is really, it's the story of St. George, it's the story of martyrs, it's the story of St. Christopher and Sword and Serpent, my book, but all of that is sort of the planting of the seeds and drops of water on the soul of Constantine, because he becomes this pivotal emperor, and he is the link between pagan, satanic, draconian Rome and what becomes the Holy Roman Empire and Christendom. Indeed. And it's really beautiful. And I don't think people, Christians, and in particular, I mean, Catholics, they don't fully appreciate the magnitude of what happened in the space of 50 to 100 years. A magnificent transformation happened in civilization, in Rome, where Peter died, where Paul died, where they received the crown of martyrdom, and how their blood was the seed of the church, and that Rome, which was the great persecutor of the apostles, becomes the mother and the mistress of all the faithful, beginning in the 300s.
This is what I've seen amongst many Catholics, is just a lack of appreciation of the great heroes of the church from the past, and really recognizing the fullness of their stories and their heroism. So I think it's really great to see this book that has caught on, has become very popular. But, you know, that's one of the things I want to rectify. I'm trying to do with my podcast. I want to, I'm going to be doing a series on the counter revolutions. like the Carlists and the Vendée and stuff like that. And I think, you know, in some ways, George fits in with them very nicely. But I want to.
No, I think your first episode should be on St. George. It should be on the Diocletian martyrs. Yeah.
Well, because this is it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is it. Maybe we're our first episode. Yeah. I mean, the idea here is we have to be careful because the minions of Satan, and these are those who persecuted Christ. These are those who persecuted the apostles, the early church, all the way up through Islam, the Reformation, the French Revolution, the infiltration of the church in the 1800s and the 1900s, all of this, Freemasonry, all of this has a sinister and sinful modus operandi based on deceit and infiltration. We, as disciples of Jesus Christ, do not have the liberty or the luxury of co-opting their sinister plots and doing the same thing. So we have to fight with a different set of weapons. And our Lord Jesus Christ tells us in the Beatitudes and elsewhere in the Gospels that this entails, as they hated me, so they will hate you. You will suffer persecution for my name's sake, right? For the sake of righteousness. And so part of our power, part of our conquest as the one Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church is our suffering, our persecution, our isolation, and then the ultimate gift to Christ, and that is our martyrdom. And even in the French Revolution, when you see these beautiful and glorious nuns going to the guillotine and losing their heads for Jesus Christ, these are the events that turn the tide of history back to Jesus Christ. So counter-revolution for us is not, let's be revolutionaries like they are, but we'll talk about Jesus. Our counter-revolution includes blood. And the cup or the chalice of blood begins to fill with the death of Christ, who has the infinite blood of atonement, propitiation. And then he sends Peter and Paul to Rome and Thomas to India and the apostles throughout the world. They become martyrs. And then you start seeing the confessors and the martyrs and the virgins. And this cup begins to fill up until the time of the year of our Lord, 303 or 304. And then we start to see a political change. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, says Tertullian. And so in the 300s, suddenly, the worst persecution, the Diocletian persecution, it was the 10th Roman persecution, the worst one. That ends, and then suddenly, we have a Roman emperor in Constantine who not only legalizes Christianity, but starts taking a magnificent amount of money from the Roman treasury and building and financing Catholic churches. He doesn't fund the heretics. Even there's a controversy with the Donatists. He has the Pope rule on it. He goes, are these guys with you? They're Catholic or not? And he goes, no, they're not. And he goes, no money for you guys. You know, you guys don't get possession of churches. So within one generation, within the space of 40 years, you go from bishops, priests, lay people experiencing violent martyrdoms like St. George, who we talk about today, to bishops living in palaces, bishops getting travel expenses from Constantine to come to Nicaea for the first ecumenical council to discuss the deity of Christ on the bill of the Roman Empire. So a magnificent change, and it's not, and I think some might be tempted to say, well, if we all we need to do is we need to get a Roman emperor to convert, and then we'll get all that. That's true, but you have to realize that there were three centuries of martyrdoms filling the cup of blood, right? Preparing, sanctifying the Roman Empire for this moment. And even when Constantine converts, you know, he's not that fervent of a Catholic. Allegedly, he's baptized on his deathbed. There's different traditions on that, whether he was baptized in Rome or baptized later, right before he died. His sons were a wreck. You know, you got Arianism. You know, really the Christological fires continue to burn up until 381. If you want to count Nestorianism and the Monophysites all the way into the 5th, 6th, 7th century, going all the way as far as Spain. I mean, it's still not tidied up. It's still not clean. But by the time you get to 800 and you get to Charlemagne, now you really have something that looks like Christendom. And it starts peaking out for another 400 years into the 1200s, right? And doesn't really decline until the 17, 1800s. And now you're sort of in our situation. Maybe the restrainer, the catechon is gone. I don't know. These are things I talk about in some of my books and some of my shows. But St. George is a liminal saint. He's on the border between catacombs, persecution, martyrdom, and the life of Constantine. So in book one of Sword and Serpent trilogy, I have George come to Rome for the first time. And he comes there with his friend Minos, who you learn later in the book is St. Christopher, who also is a martyr. He's guided there and led there by St. Nicholas, who we know as Santa Claus, but this is the real St. Nicholas, who has powers of sanctity. He can bilocate. He can read souls. He's, in my book, St. Nicholas is very much like a Padre Pio or an Obi-Wan Kenobi type figure who is leading and showing the destiny of George and St. George, who's a younger man. He goes to Rome because there's a prophecy about a sword in a stone and a dragon and the conversion of the empire and dragons and all these things. And I'm laying the groundwork here for all the later Arthurian legends of sword and the stone. But I'm placing stone here with Kepha, Cephas, Petros, Peter. So I'm taking the Roman story of the stone of St. Peter and I'm interjecting it with Arthurian legend, St. George, you know, chivalry, all that stuff. I'm kind of just mapping it on top of it. Our Western tradition does that. I don't know if anyone's ever done it in a literary way like I have, but I'm just taking all these traditions and just stacking them on and just sort of putting the thread through it all. And so George comes to Rome and he sees Constantine for the first time. And later on in the book, they do meet again. They do get to know one another. And George does have some interaction with St. Helen, who's the mother of Constantine. She is a committed Catholic from early on. And they get to know some of these bishops, monks, mystics. There's even some desert mothers in my book in Egypt. They get to know these people, and some of these converts are now higher in the court. So you now have this controversy of not everyone at court is a pagan Roman. There are now people in court who are Christians secretly, some of them not secretly. And how is that dealt with? And then, of course, Helen, his mother, is a Catholic, is a Christian. So there's already this kind of tolerance of Christianity, but they're still martyrs. There's still the danger of losing your head, you know, or being thrown to the lions. So St. George is a good saint for our time because, Connor, I think we're kind of on the opposite end of this. We are coming out of a Christian culture. Really, you know, I think since the death of Blessed Karl of Austria, was that 1917?
No, I think he died in like the 20s, I think. I think like 22, maybe 23. Yeah,
let me see. 1918. He died in 1918.
No, he lost
by a year.
He lost power in 1918.
Oh, no, you're right. That's the reign. Yeah, you're right. He died in 2022. All right. He lost the reign in 18 and he died in 1922. So yeah, I mean, that kind of signals, you know, the last emperor. And, you know, in the Good Friday liturgy and in the Holy Saturday liturgy, he was commemorated, right? Mm-hmm. That the end of that is again a liminal moment where, you know, we're coming out of Christendom really in the 1700s. Well, with the Reformation, it really fractures. In the 1700s, state governments start going outwardly anti-Catholic, anti-Christian. The 1800s is a definite move. The loss of the Papal States in 1870. World War I might as well be called the war against Catholic monarchy or against monarchy. And we are now living the mirror image, the opposite of what George was living. George was living at the moment of coming out of paganism into Catholic Christendom. We are basically out of Catholic Christendom and moving into full-on paganism.
Another moment kind of that reflects that, what you're saying, is when, in my opinion, with Constantine and Nicaea, you know, and helping put it together, and then with Franz Josef doing his papal veto, or his veto over who's going to become pope in the early 20th century, and then the removal of that ability going forward by Pius X is kind of a end of also like the state participating in that Christian culture, even though that wasn't, I don't think obviously that was his intent, Pius X's removal of that, but it's just kind of a connection.
No, it definitely signifies that there is no longer an integration of the church and the state. And I mean, we could go one further, Connor. And I mean, the fact that Pope Benedict XVI died on December 31st, which is the feast of Saint Sylvester. And Saint Sylvester is the Pope of Constantine's time. So Benedict XVI himself dies on the feast of the Pope who was the Pope of this great transition from persecution, martyrdom, paganism into an integration of church and state and Christendom. So, you know, I really think that the last 100 years has been the scrubbing away of all that's Christian, all that's Catholic, that's remnant in society. That puts us in a dangerous situation. And I think it helps us recall that we might, just as martyrs were on the border of paganism to Catholicism, we now might be moving into that age of martyrdom once again. And so Saint George, our saint today, is an excellent saint. And most people think of him as killing a dragon, but we need to remember that George in the early church was seen as a great martyr. And his defeat of the dragon is in his martyrdom.
Indeed. The sword and the serpent, one of the things I love most about the book is the ending. The ending, I'm a sucker for a good ending, and I thought it was just probably one of the best endings for the first book.
Yeah, the ending, and I don't want to give it away for people, but my novel, Sword and Serpent, it's the first in a trilogy. And by the way, a lot of people don't know this, Connor, but there are purposefully 1,453 pages in the trilogy because Constantinople fell in 1453.
Okay. Right.
And this is the story of Constantine and the Roman Empire. Constantinople means the city of Constantine, right? So there's all this symbolism in there. And I don't want to give away the first book, Sword and Serpent.
Do I have a copy of it? Let me see if I have a copy. So people can see what it looks like. Yeah, here we go.
Sword and Serpent. But he fights the dragon. In the end of this book, he goes toe-to-toe with the dragon. The ancient medieval chronicles say that the dragon was in Cyllene, with an L, Cyllene. And no one really knows where that is. George himself is from the Palestinian area, northern Palestine area. in those regions, maybe up towards in Lebanon or to Asia Minor. And so I've situated the story in those areas, but I put the battle in Cyrene, which is the only geographic location that has any semblance to the medieval chronicle. And I like that decision. The reason I made that decision is because Saint Simon of Cyrene was from Cyrene, and he helped Jesus carry the cross. And I wanted there to be a relic of the true cross in the story, but here's the problem. The relic of the true cross was discovered by Saint Helen decades after this story. So if the true cross is in a well in Jerusalem, which is where they found it, how do I have a relic of the true cross in 303? Impossible. So in the novel, in the fiction, I have another relic of the true cross. It's a giant splinter. I made this up. Okay, this is not historical, but it's a giant splinter that when Simon of Cyrene was helping Christ carry the cross, that got lodged into the hand of Simon of Cyrene. Afterwards, he takes that splinter out, this large splinter, and it's kept in Jerusalem, right? And eventually, not to ruin the story, but it's given to St. George by St. Nicholas. I'm giving away a lot here. But anyway, it's it's with the wood. And in the story, you know, George kills the dragon with a wooden lance. And so in my story, he kind of does the same, but it's also because George is carrying this wooden splinter, this piece of the cross, and that connects the power of the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, the triumph of the cross, with George, Gergios, Jurian, who's bearing the wood of the cross on him. And that's also connects him with Helen and Constantine as the discoverers of the true cross. So he engages the dragon, and in my story, the dragon is, it's metaphysical, it's real, and I don't want to give it away, but it's Roman and it's imperial, and it's connected with the prophet Daniel, and it's connected with the book of the Apocalypse. And there's a real diabolical, Luciferian, satanic dialogue that happens between George and the dragon, and it'll make your hair stand on end. It's scary, it's freaky. It would make a great movie. It would make a great film. Kennedy Hall, I'm going to do an interview with Kennedy today. Kennedy Hall read the audio version of the book. So if you want to listen to the Audible version, that's read by Kennedy Hall. And he narrates that dialogue between George and the dragon. And I think that's kind of cool too, because in the story, there's not a lot of, there's no dialogue between St. George and the dragon. But in our tradition, like even if you look at like Tolkien, Lord of the Rings, like dragons that talk are really scary, right?
It did feel very Tolkienian.
Yes, good. That's a compliment. I like that. But if you think about it, dragons should talk. Why? Because Genesis chapter 3, right? The snake comes out and doesn't bite Eve on the ankle. It talks to her. It beguiles her with language and with Luciferian logic. And so I think that's what makes my dragon and sword and serpent, so scary, is because you see how smart he is and how sinister he is and how much he gets into the psychology and the self-doubt and the insecurities that George, you've seen in the story with George. You realize the flaws in St. George, and the dragon immediately burrows into those wounds of St. George and just starts laying eggs like maggots and gets into the psyche and soul of George. George wins. But there is this almost like, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Because he is talking to Satan. He's talking to Dracula, the little dragon. He's talking to the dragon. So yeah, I mean, read it. Sword and Serpent. It's a fun read. I highly encourage it. I think it's a great story. I'm glad you liked it. I'm glad you found it Tolkien.
I did. Yeah, no, it's a great read. Very enjoyable. I also listened to parts of it on Audible, and Kennedy Hall does such a great job with that conversation, with the confrontation between George and the dragon. And I totally forgot, like, after listening to it for a while, that it was Kennedy. Like, it just, I almost forget he's narrating it.
Well, Kennedy does so many different voices, and he just does a really good job. I mean, I wasn't sure. He had mentioned about reading it for me, and I was like, I don't know. And then I heard him do the Charles, the Father Murr book, Murder in the 33rd Degree, and he had different voices. Like, okay, this could maybe work in Sword and Serpent. And so I had him do like one or two chapters, and he sent them to me. And I was like, okay. And then when I heard him do Minas, who's St. Christopher, and do some of those dialogues, I was like, this is it. Let's do it. So he's done all, Sword and Serpent is a trilogy, and there's a fourth book that came out at Christmas called Nicolaus, about St. Nicholas. He's done all four books.
Is that so, the last, is the St. Nicholas book, or Nicolaus, is that separate?
Or, yeah, so Nicolaus is kind of in the Sword and Serpent universe. It's an origin story. It's the origin of St. Nicholas.
Okay.
And it's outside the trilogy, but I don't want to give away too much. But as you get to the end of Nicolaus, the newest book, it's not part of the trilogy. You'll see how it links into the trilogy. Like, it's connected, right?
Do you think there'll be an Arthurian sort of trilogy, you know, maybe?
Writing books is a lot of work and a lot of planning and research and all that. So I have sometimes I'm like, yes, the next phase is the Arthurian trilogy. We're going to pick up where these books left off. Now, book three, here's Sword and Serpent one. Here's Sword and Serpent two, just translated in Croatian last month. And this is book three, Storm of Fire and Blood. There is a lot going on in Britannia in this trilogy. So they do go to Britain. And there's a lot of cool things that happen there. There is sort of this homage to Merlin that goes on in this book as well, but in a Christian way. It's fun. It's interesting. There's a lot of sort of engagement with the religion of Odin and Thor and early Christians in Northern Europe, in, you know, Gothic regions, in Great Britain. So all that stuff's happening. So like everything is set up for a Sword and Stone. And if you read the end of the trilogy, there is a very strong homage to Sword and Stone mythology at the very end of the whole trilogy with Constantine present. So, and of course, you know, Constantine's father was in Britain. His mother allegedly was from Britain. So there are a lot of, and he was crowned emperor in York. Constantine was. So he has a lot of connections to Britain. And so taking this George story and the chivalry story and the stone story and the sword story and all of this and connecting it to George's new home as the patron of England is attractive. Is fun, and who knows? We'll see.
And whether you have time.
Yeah.
Well, so did your former Episcopalian priesthood have anything to do with the creation of this trilogy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, George is the patron of England. He has a special patronage in Anglicanism, even though Anglicanism generally, not in the high church parties, but generally is against the devotion to the saints. George is, I mean, he's part of the Episcopal Church's coat of arms, the red and white, you know, banner, the shield. Honestly, Sword and Serpent and the trilogy began as bedtime stories that I told my oldest son. He's almost 22 years old now, right? So these stories go back 18 years, and I'm telling him bedtimes. He was really into knights and chivalry, and so I would tell him stories about knights and wars and battles and kind of Arthurian stuff. But, you know, we had just become Catholic as a family, and so I started bringing in St. George and St. Christopher and St. Catherine and all these saints who were from, you know, around the same time period, AD 300, and started weaving them into these bedtime stories. And I remember telling a priest, I was like, yeah, I tell these bedtime stories to my son. And, you know, they're about all these saints and the kind of blending history with, he goes, that's really cool. He's like, you should write that down. So I remember writing down the first draft of Sword and Serpent. And that was probably 2007 was when I first drafted out the first book. And then it didn't come out until 2014. I think today's the 10th anniversary. I have to go back and check, but I think today's the 10th anniversary of, of Sword and Serpent. Yeah. So
congratulations.
It took another 7 years to be published. So yeah, and grow and change and mature and all that.
How was it a real challenge sort of woving in all of the different saints into the story? Was that a real challenge?
No, it was fun. Like, it was almost like, how I got to find another. So just looking at, you get a collection of all the saints, the martyrs, you look at all their death dates, and then you look at all their geographies and you kind of map that out and you're like, oh, Saint Blaise was in Armenia. George is going to be moving through that area. I might as well have him have an encounter with Saint Blaise in Armenia. So I would do that, you know. Or as he, you know, goes through Asia Minor, oh, well, St. Nicholas would have been a recently ordained priest, right, in Myra. So he's going to be going through those ports anyway. I might as well have him meet St. Nicholas here, you know. And then when he's in Rome, I'm like, okay, well, who are the bishops, popes, deacons, priests who were in Rome that we know at that time? And of course, you know, if he goes into a catacomb, he's going to meet one of these real historical saints. So I think that's one of the people have, we call it the Easter eggs, right? You're like reading through the book and people are, and I change the names slightly or make them more Greek or more Latin. And so people will be reading, they're like, oh, that's Saint Anastasia, you know, or, oh, that's Saint Christopher. And, you know, a lot of saints that people never heard of are actually in the book. So I don't think it was hard. I think it was kind of fun. I'm into that stuff anyway. So, and that's how this whole thing started, was taking real saints and plugging them in the stories. So I think that's kind of the wholesome fun or the genius of the trilogy.
Where does the name Manus come from? Because it seems so different from Christopher.
So yeah, Saint Christ, there's two traditions of a giant, a man who is a giant, who is a martyr. And they're from the same time period. In the Coptic church, he's called Saint Menas, M-E-N-A-S. And in the Roman church and in the Greek church, he's called Saint Christopher. Now, Christophoros is the Greek. Christo means Christ. Phoros means carrier, bearer, right? Mm-hmm. Probably not his real name. So there's been some research done on this, and there was a very famous martyr, and his devotion begins either in the Egyptian area, Palestinian area, Syria, but definitely in the Eastern Mediterranean. And he's a great martyr. There are accounts of his martyrdom, but he's unnamed. And so it's thought that since he was a martyr, they called him the Christ bearer. Was unknown. In the Egyptian church, there's a very almost the identical same story as Christopher from the almost same time period, but they call him Saint Menas, M-E-N-A-S. So what I did is I just, and maybe I'm wrong, but I'm like, these gotta be the same guy. Right? Sounds like the same guy. Two different names. So in the book, I call him Menas, but as the story goes on, you realize that his story, his characteristics, everything about him corresponds to the Saint Christopher legend. So in a way, I'm just taking these two legends that are basically the same legend, and I'm not the first one to do this. Other people have said, I think Menas is Christopher, or Christopher is Menas. I just do it in the story.
What's his ethnicity? Where's he from?
Minas?
Yeah.
So there are icons of him with a dog head. Have you ever seen that?
No, I have not.
You haven't? Okay. So there are icons of Christopher with a dog head. And the reason for that is because in the legends, in the ancient legends, it says he's a Canaanite. And in Latin, as you know, canine means dog.
Okay.
Right? Canaanite is someone from Canaan, right? But so there was this confusion with early scribes where St. Christopher was described as a Canaanite. And so people said, oh, he was a canine. So there's actually images. If you go on Google and just search in St. Christopher dog head, you'll find actual icons, Byzantine icons of St. Christopher. It's kind of odd. So his ethnicity is Canaanite, which again places him in the Eastern Empire.
I can't remember, but in the book, it's related. He's related to the Goliath, right?
Yeah. So there's also the story that in the Canaanites, of course, are related to the Philistines, right? They're from Canaan, and so in the story, I kind of have Minas, Christopher, as sort of this mystical liminal creature who he has six toes and six fingers, which is something that, you know, Goliath and some of the Philistines have. It's an odd feature that they have, and that he was possessed. That's part of the legend and the story of Saint Christopher. He was at one point very wicked and served Satan, and then had a massive conversion. And the story is that, you know, he would rob and steal and do all these horrible things. And one day he was sitting on the side of a river, and a small child came to him. His original name was Reprobos, which means reprobate, and said, "Would you please, there's no bridge here, will you please carry me over the river?" Normally he would have, you know, beat the child, stolen from the child, but something about this child was different. So he said, "Okay, hop on my back and I'll carry you over the river." So Christopher starts going, and as he gets about halfway across the river, the child is so heavy, it's bearing him down. Now, mind you, he's a giant, but he's pushing him down, and his face, his beard is getting wet, and he's choking on the water, and he thinks he's going to drown, and he just barely makes it all the way across the river, and then he places the child on the ground, and he says, you know, "Dear child, how do you weigh so much?" And the child says, "You weren't feeling my weight, you were feeling the weight of the sins of the world." And then suddenly the child grows up into a full-grown man, and it is Jesus Christ. And in this moment, Christopher has a conversion. He realizes he's been worshiping and serving Satan. He wants to worship Christ. And in some traditions, he's baptized by Jesus Christ there in the river and becomes a new man. So part of his name is not only that he bears Christ as a martyr later on in his life, but that he actually carried Christ across the river on his back. And so he is the Christ bearer, the Christ. So in the book, that is definitely a part of the story, because it's a great story.
Yeah. I knew it was Christopher, right? Like, you know, sort of giant. I was like, I just thought it was so clever also just calling him a giant. I just thought that made it a much more sort of, mythical story, you know, not just a large man.
And it's kind of Tolkien, you know, but all throughout the Bible are references to these peripheral persons who are bad and they're giants. You know, like before the Israelites go into Canaan, they're like, there's giants living there. We're afraid to go there. And that's why one of the reasons why God punishes them is they're afraid of the giants. So Canaan, the Philistines do have these giant type people. And I think it's cool that you have one of the most evil examples of the remnants of the Philistines or remnants of the Canaanites who becomes not only a great saint, a great martyr, but in this story, he becomes the Samwise Gamgee of St. George. He is the faithful friend. In a way, he is the true hero. He might be my favorite character in the book besides Nicholas, because he carries and encourages George along the sort of sorrowful way for George. And he always bears sort of a jolly joyfulness in the book. He's the most carefree character, even though he was the most evil. So he's kind of almost like a male Mary Magdalene. Like, he was so evil, and now he's saved, he's redeemed, and now he's just so happy and so grateful. And so he is that source of brightness and joy. And, you know, there's kind of the jokes and the fun parts of the book almost always relate to Minas or St. Christopher in all three books.
Yeah. Or two. You mentioned that he is associated with dogs, because canine and stuff like that. It makes me think that one day, if I'm blessed to be a saint, many years from now, in the future, maybe Latin will be taken up as a common language again, and they're going to associate me with dogs because my name literally translates to lover of hounds.
Okay, there you go.
So, that it seems like a similar association, right. I guess.
Exactly. Yeah, and then the Dominicans, are called hounds of heaven, right? Because Dominicanus or Dominicanus means dog of the Lord, if you put a space in there. So it's another kind of play on words.
Was that that wasn't the original intention by any stretch of the imagination?
No. Dominic, but Dominic was his name, which means, it means pertaining to the Lord.
Okay.
But
yeah. So
once he had followers who were Dominicani or Dominicanus, then people were like, "Oh, it's kind of funny. If you splice it right there, it literally means a dog of God, a hound of the Lord, hounds of heaven." So, yeah, it's kind of fun.
That is very funny.
Medieval people had a good sense of humor.
Good, and it seems like that dying away.
Yeah.
People really don't have a sense of humor these days.
So, Connor, I'm curious, who is your favorite character in Sword and Serpent? Every time I meet someone who says, "Hey, I read it, whatever, my first question is, who's your favorite character? Because I've been surprised over the past 10 years how varied that answer is. So I'm curious.
I think I'm so hung up on George that it's just got to be George. It's Jurian.
Which, a where lot does, of people like.
Sorry, where does Jurian come from? The name I always got confused. Because you talk about the name a bunch in the book, but what? Because Georgios is Latin, right?
Greek.
Sorry,
Georgios is Greek. It means worker of the land, worker of the earth. Comes in the Latin as Georgios, right? People read the book. They start reading the book, and they read a few chapters, and they're like, "Where is St. George?" And when they realize Jurian, eventually you realize Jurian's real name, his birth name is Georgios, right? George. But everyone calls him Jurian, right? Now, if you grew up like in Canada or I think certain Germanic countries, even Eastern European countries, Jurian is a diminutive or a nickname of George. Just like if someone's named William, you can call him Billy. It's the same, it comes from that. Jurian is related to the name George. In my book, though, if you'll remember, it's in the first few chapters, George's father, who's died, and there's some mystery about the death of his father. And of course, his mother is killed, and that's another kind of difficult scene to read, but he served in the Germanic regions in the Roman military with a man, and he brought that name Jurian back with him. So that was the name that his father called him. So it's more of a Germanic name, and it's kind of related to, it has an affinity to George, but it's sort of the pet name that his father uses. And as the book goes on, and as George, Jurian becomes more prominent and starts having more and more prestige in the Roman Empire, gets to know Constantine in the Roman court. Because the story of George is he gets pretty high in the Roman Empire, and then they find out he's a Christian, and then they kill him, and they kill him in a horrible way. So as he excels, he more and more takes on his real Greek and Latin name, which is Gergios, George. You know, that's his real name. But in the beginning, I didn't want readers to read from page one and impose and import everything they think they know about St. George. Mm-hmm. So I wanted him to be a little bit more shadowy and a little bit less formed in the reader's mind. And so Jurian, but by, I think around chapter three or chapter four, it's clearly stated that his name is Gergios George. That's his real name. So,
well, yeah, as an author, you need to be able to play around with it.
Yeah, and the same thing with Christopher. I don't want people, when they first meet him, to say, oh, St. Christopher, I have a St. Christopher medal, and I want them to kind of know the character, and then at a certain point, it's like, oh, that is, like you said, oh, that's St. Christopher. You know?
Yeah.
Nicolaus, all these people. Obviously, Constantine right away, oh, that's Constantine, but a lot of the saints, I wanted them to sort of grow and stand on their own merits as a literary character and then let the reader assimilate, oh, this is Saint so-and-so. Because, you know, when we think of like, if I think of like Saint Maximilian Kolbe, like I think of holy cards and books, I've, you know, like documentaries. But if I were going to read a story about Maximilian, I'd want to be more eased into who is this young Maximilian, right? Without importing the holy cards into that story from page one.
Indeed. I cut you off about sort of the accidentally about you asking other people who they say their favorite character is. Is George common, or are you surprised by who they say?
I'd say George is maybe 50% of readers' favorite. Minas or Christopher comes in really high. Nicholas comes in really high. He's probably second besides George. And then also, not just female readers, but a lot of readers like I. Katerina, who's St. Catherine, she comes in book two. She's got a big following, St. Catherine. She's a snarky teenage philosopher trained on Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. She's very unhappy with Egyptian paganism. She's striving to understand something monotheistic, and then she meets Christians. She becomes St. Catherine of Alexandria, who's also a martyr. She's also a great, feisty, fun character and an intellectual genius in the story. She's the most philosophical character, and she's female. So a lot of men and women like her and are attached to her. She comes about in book two. And then a lot of people like Eva, also known as Sabra. She is the girl who is a priestess of the dragon. She offers human sacrifice to the dragon in Cyrene. She's a Phoenician or Punic princess and priestess and witch. And she is completely in bondage to Satan and the serpent, the dragon. And she is redeemed in this story. If you see an icon or image of St. George, you'll see George on his white horse, plunging the lance into the dragon, killing the dragon. And in the background is a girl who is usually chained to a rock. This is the traditional depiction of St. George. And that girl in my novel is Sabra, a.k.a. Eva, Eva meaning Eve in Latin. So she's a new Eve. She's been defeated by Satan. She serves Satan. Satan has dialogued with her, and she has agreed to Satan. And George comes in as a Christological character and defeats her. And even at a certain point at the end of the book, St. Nicholas appears. He bilocates into the scene and removes the chains from her as she's chained to the rock. And that's sort of an allegorical exorcism of removing the chains of Satan from her so that she's redeemed. There's a lot going on there, but she's an interesting character because she's also kind of a Mary Magdalene. She's so dark. She's kind of like, I don't want people to take this the wrong way, but she's kind of goth. She's obsessed with death. She's known death from her childhood. She's obsessed with the serpent, with the dragon. It's all she knows. Her whole vision is obscured with blackness, shadows, and death. And she knows that somehow the answer to this downward spiral into death should be some kind of a resurrection, some kind of meaning, you know, fulfillment. But she doesn't have any vocabulary or any understanding of how that could be, but she knows somehow there should be. And so when she gets exposed to St. George and starts meeting some Christians, she herself starts to long for and want to realize in herself, although she's so sinful, maybe that could apply to me. And ultimately it does, because Jurian redeems her. He saves her, and her father offers her as his wife. This is in the original legend. And Jurian, St. George, says, no, I'm called to be celibate. I'm called to be a celibate warrior. She's beautiful. I love your daughter. I redeemed her, but I'm not going to marry her. I have more mission ahead of me. And that's what's so cool about St. George. You know,
as I said, he could have had a
beautiful princess and become the next king of Cyrenia. And instead, he just sort of like rides off into the sunset. And you're like, well, what's next for George? So that's book two, and that's book three.
Yeah, the ending of the first one is just so good. Yeah. It's, you know, there are some books that are not fulfilling, not like you get to the end and you're just like, well, I like the way to this point, but well, that was really disappointing. And this is not that kind of book at all.
Well, good. Well, thank you, Connor. I appreciate that.
Now, St. George in the story, when he meets all of these people, in the beginning, he's very much not really sure about Christianity. He doesn't really understand what his family has been doing. He almost seems like he's been left in the dark, but he's also been listening to the stories and ignoring them. It feels like sort of also a good read for young men who are just sort of waking up to what they're living in as maybe a middle school or high school and that sort of thing. Is that kind of the intention behind it?
Yeah. I mean, Connor, I'm a storyteller. Like on my podcast, I'm telling stories, right? It's just what I do. I'm a narrative. I'm a storyteller. And so when you think about, okay, I need to paint a picture. I need to create a movie. I need to write a book. And I have to keep people turning the page for 300 something pages, right? You got to think like that. How do I keep them? You always think of a character arc, right? Where does he start on page one, and where does he end on the last page? And that whole arc has to be interesting. There has to be fruit and drama and nuggets and developments on every single page of that whole arc. So that means you have to start off St. George far away from defeats a dragon, redeems a virgin goth princess, you know, witch, and then goes on to be one of the greatest martyrs in the Catholic Church, right? How do you get him there? So, you know, to make that story compelling, he can't start off on page one, you know, praying the rosary and going to mass. So I have, you know, his father was a great Roman officer who died mysteriously. He loved his father. He idolized his father. His father is gone, and he has a deep insecurity of who he is as a man. He's taking care of his mom and his little sister, and there are no men in his life. His mother is deeply religious. She is a Catholic Christian in a persecuted culture. And his sister is also taken to practicing the religion. So you can tell that the mother is well catechized. The daughter is well catechized. They seem to participate in the Sunday liturgy and the Eucharist. He, however, is a teenage boy who's longing to have his father back, who's dead, and wants to somehow step into the boots of his Roman officer father and prove that he is just like his father, a dignified, glorious Roman soldier and officer. So that's how the book opens up. But there's these prophecies and there's these meetings and he meets these people and his mother is martyred. And there's his, I don't want to give away too much, but his sister is martyred and he starts losing people and he starts realizing that this story about Jesus Christ, this ancient story, and presumably his father was Christian too, there's something about it. And he identifies as a Christian. It's just not how he thinks about the world. He's challenged over and over, and especially by St. Nicholas, and especially when he gets to Rome and sees the catacombs, he realizes more and more that the vocation to be a soldier and the vocation to fight and the vocation for honor and dignity is more and more, as he understands it, wrapped up in the cross of Jesus and overcoming evil, not just other armies. This is through the influence of St. Christopher, St. Nicholas, and whatnot. So, you know, you start to see him. He has the same ideals. I want to be a soldier. I want to be like my dad. But then all this starts to get Christotelic, Christocentric, Christological, right? And so he begins to develop so that by the time you finish book one, he has conformed to the image and likeness of Christ. He's become a Christ-like figure. And it's kind of a surprise. And honestly, like his dialogue with the dragon before he had his battle with the dragon, which is very dramatic, but his very interior and psychological doubts, his fears, all of his insecurities, as I think a lot of young men today, teenage boys without father figures or without strong father figures or longing for something strong and powerful, all those broken areas and wounds get exposed by Satan, and yet he still conquers. How? Through that little splinter of the true cross, which is suffering, the wood of the cross. And so that's the character arc. Man, I gave away too much, man. People who haven't read the book are going to hear all this, and they're getting too much info. But that's the character of St. George from a immature adolescent on his way to adulthood to finally reaching adulthood. You know, in the very final scenes, Connor, I kind of even mentioned the stubble on his face and some other details. And those are very like subtle narrative ways. You can't just say, and now George was a man. That's like really the main story. You have to paint it, you know? And so there's these indications as the story goes on that he's less and less an adolescent and more a man. But that relates to his conformity to Jesus, to Christ. And then in the next two books, you really see him grinding through that identity, which ultimately leads to him receiving a horrific, gruesome martyrdom. But he faces it manfully. He faces it as a true hero. And you'll see that by him doing that, those droplets of blood are what sparks the tiny faith of Constantine, which sparks the faith of Christendom and the conversion of over a billion people.
Indeed. Well, beautiful, beautiful way to end it. I think the book is fantastic. Even, you know, what information we talked about is immensely worth reading. You should all go out and get it. The link is in the description, the Amazon link. Is there another place where it should be bought, or is it just Amazon?
No, I think Amazon's a great place. Get it there. It's been a bestseller. Here it is. And yeah, I think today's the 10th anniversary. So.
Well, it's fantastic. St. George is a fantastic saint and one we should be praying to. Dr. Taylor Marshall, thank you for coming on the show. You've been a big inspiration for this channel as well as just my faith life. So I want to thank you. For all of you listeners and watchers, please like, share, comment, and subscribe if you like this kind of interviews or conversations, or even, you know, sort of talking about these types of topics. You know, my series on counter-revolutionaries is going to be continuing, and I'm really excited about it. I'm going to have lots of different people on to discuss different movements, and we're going to learn from those stories. So thank you again, Dr. Marshall. Anything to say before we go?
Remember, our Lord Jesus Christ is the light of the world and the salt of the earth. So go out there and be salty. Happy St. George Day.
God bless everyone. Bye.
Thank you, Connor.